fundamentally, the thing that makes us human is our ability to kind of engage in like social deliberation.
This podcast was made us more human. That's, I love that. Except for when you didn't hold back about bullying me about Sun Eater. That happened multiple times. That was actually inhuman.
That was us holding you accountable.
Well, so that, actually, that was yeah, us yeah. communicating. Welcome everyone to the Two Random Podcast. My name is Richard.
My name is Austin.
Today we are joined by a special guest, Jared Henderson from YouTube. You should also go check him out on Substack. Thank you so much for coming on, Jared.
Absolutely. No, it's a pleasure to be here, guys.
Jared has a PhD in philosophy and he left academia to join us Kremlins on YouTube and do a bunch of other cool stuff. But we specifically have you on, Jared, because Rich and I get philosophical, but we have no background in philosophy, and we think there's no better topic to discuss with you than the big sci-fi topic of what makes us human. How does sci-fi define humanity, exploring aliens, robots, and everything in between, and just getting down to it. So Jared, thanks so much for coming on, and what is your solution to this whole thing of what makes us human?
Well, yeah, you know, it's going to depend a lot on the exact way that we phrase the problem, I think. So I think the best thing that you can do anytime you want to do any kind of like philosophy stuff is to start asking good questions, figuring out what's wrong with the questions, and we keep like kind of refining them as we go, and then the answer is going to get better. So hopefully sort of through that process, it's like it's all back in Plato, man. It's all back in Socrates. So we'll just keep doing that until we feel satisfied, or like most of the characters in a Platonic dialogue, we either get too drunk to continue the conversation or we get too angry to continue the conversation. It's just one of those two options.
So if we're not drunk and throwing things at each other by the end of the conversation, we did it wrong.
Exactly.
Got it.
Precisely. Now, which one of us gives off the drunk and the angry vibe? Who do you think it'll be?
I feel like, Richard, I feel like you're the sort of quiet, angry guy.
Oh, you got it nailed. Are you also a psychiatrist?
And a mind reader, just moonlighting as it. But yeah, yeah, you know, you're sort of like the Arthur meme, clenching your fists. just waiting to explode.
Sorry, Rich, I cut you off on a question. So go ahead. What were you going to say?
In that vein of asking question, trying to figure out a better one, the question that we kind of start off with, it's on our thumbnail, it's on our title, all that. What makes us human? What is wrong with that question?
Yeah, okay, cool. So there's like a couple of things to think about when we get that question. Like one, I think it's actually a very good question. It's just like so broad, right? Mm-hmm. So you might think that like human beings as sort of like whatever we are, we fall under multiple different kinds of categories, right? So on the one hand, you could just give like a purely biological definition, right? A human being is someone who has like this kind of like biological makeup or like this kind of, I don't know, this many chromosomes or something. You have to deal with all the exceptions to that, right? Because there are human beings who like won't fit sort of neatly into any of those paradigms. Coming up with a fully generated answer is difficult. And yet that also kind of feels like it leaves something out. There's kind of a famous example, sort of an apocryphal story of a philosopher trying to define a human being, and they say that a human being is a featherless biped, right? And that sounds pretty good. Oh. We don't have feathers. We walk on two legs, right? And it's said that Diogenes the Cynic goes to the market, finds a plucked chicken, and holds it up and says, "Behold, a man," right? That's a featherless biped right there. Yeah. And so it says, like, there's got to be something a little more nuanced about what it is here, too. But also, I think just treating us as purely sort of physical or biological beings or something leaves out all the stuff that actually we probably care about. Mm-hmm. If through like some weird, you know, you went through like some weird sci-fi device, Richard, and you came out exactly as you are, but actually instead of being like a carbon-based life form, you were like a silicon-based life form, but everything else kind of on the surface seemed the same, you felt the same, you had all the same memories and stuff, I feel like we'd still say you're Richard, and in some sense it would feel like you're still human, or you would still kind of be in sort of this community of persons that we talk about. So obviously like whatever we mean by like what is a human has to be a little bit more robust than just like a purely biological answer, right?
Sure.
But another kind of different question about it is like, do you mean human being purely as like a category in natural science? Or do you mean a sort of moral category that philosophers would call persons, right? What makes us a person? And the idea is that persons, currently we kind of think of ourselves as the best example of persons. We think maybe some animals could be persons if they're like sort of smart enough and they have like kind of the right social features. But when you get into science fiction, that ends up being a super relevant question because you encounter creatures that aren't humans, clearly, but we feel like we could love them. We could be friends with them. We could hate them. We could hold them accountable. We could blame them if they do wrong, right? So they already get kind of tangled up in like our web of morality. And that seems like also like a really good question to be asking too. And so already, you know, just like rambling, it takes three to ramble, but, you know, it's just rambling for a few minutes. I feel like that just like opens up a bunch of different possible avenues to explore as we think about that question.
Hearing you talk about the, so taking the first, the idea of what makes you human, it seems to me there's almost three large categories that you can frame it as. There's the purely biological aspect of what makes human in the, you know, chromosomes, your physical makeup, all that aspect. Then there's the, for lack of a better term, the soul argument. What makes the human soul? Is it your personality, your memories, your experience? And I think the third camp is the combination of the two. And that's where the sci-fi gets tricky. And I think in our minds, we like to think that we are our minds. But then when you put your mind in the silicone life form, you feel a little odd about just saying, oh, yeah, that's human. So it's are we a combination of both our mind, our soul, and our flesh? And that union of flesh and soul is important. Which category do you think has probably the most weight out of those three?
Well, I mean, I think this is hard, man. I think basically what you're doing is you're mapping out a bunch of different answers that people have tried to give to the same problem, right? Like this is like how they've tried to solve it. So there are like pure physicalists in the world who are like, you are your body. You are your physical body. Now, this is a little more about personal identity, like what makes Richard Richard, what makes Austin Austin, rather than like what makes them
probably
human.
Probably was cooler.
But,
so,
but it's like, are you just
intolerance is fully linked? It's what makes you you.
But you know, the thought might be: is it like, is Austin? Are you just your body, or are you your? Let's say if there's a soul, right? Is it like, are you your soul? Are you the combination of your soul? But also, you might think it has something to do with like psychological features. Are you your memories? Are you the fact that you're sort of this narrative being that's extended through time and kind of an unbroken chain? I don't know if there's like a knockdown argument for like any of those positions really. And then when we look to, you know, science fiction, I think we get a bunch of different weird cases, right? We have like uploading your consciousness to a machine or something like this. It still feels like it might be you in some cases, but at the same time, it kind of doesn't. There's a bunch of weird cases in some sci-fi novels of like how it all goes wrong and how like you can't even be like a stable self here. Adrian Tchaikovsky has some of that stuff. But then there's just like this, I think the more interesting question is like, what happens when you encounter like a species that is kind of nothing like us? And we know that they're not human, but we still think that there's like something to them, right? We like, they're not just mere beast, right? So there's like this like level of animal that's like pure beast. We don't expect them to be rational. And then there's like, then there's us, and we are rational animals. I feel like our rationality, our capacity for rationality is like super important. And then you meet some like alien creature or whatever, and then you see that they're rational too. Maybe their rationality looks very different from ours, but they are rational. What do you make of them when you encounter them?
To break down that first part where you're saying, hey, what makes Rich, what makes me mean, like our body, hey, it's for just being physicalists, if that's the right term.
Yeah, that'd be the right one.
If we're just talking about pure body, maybe a place to start, and then we can even get more into the next step from here, is the ship of Theseus, is it? Is that the... Correct.
So that's this thought experiment for anyone who doesn't know, right? So there's a ship. It's on a very long voyage. Over time, all of the parts get replaced kind of over time, you know, a plank here, a mast here, you know, the sail. And by the end of its voyage, none of the original parts remain, right? Mm-hmm. And the sort of question that gets raised is sort of, is it the same ship? I think that just raising it like a question is a little misleading, because actually what it is like, we all clearly think it's the same ship. Like, the whole time, Theseus would describe his ship as, like, let's go back to the ship, whatever the name of it is. And no one would ever be confused. No one would ever start to question it. However, if you, like, completely strip down all of the pieces of the ship of Theseus's ship, and then immediately rebuilt it, but with all new parts, and you didn't use any of the original parts, mm-hmm. we have, like, this strong intuition that it's not the same ship, right?
Right. Like when we talk about a human being, like stripping away maybe limbs. So, for example, there's humans who don't have prosthetic legs, have prosthetic arms, have large prosthetics, which still the same person, clearly. And then when the sci-fi element gets into it, it's not just replacing, you know, it's not just replacing physical parts. And then there's organs and moderns and the modern medicine, but then brains itself. And when we get into science fiction, when we get into what can science do to alter your memories or your personhood or who you actually mm-hmm. are versus a ship, which is just body parts, he's now getting mm-hmm. into that realm of, well, can we replace all of Richard or Austin and Jared, everything except our brain? Is it still us? Or so can we narrow it down to hypothesize that at least a brain makes us just a biological argument before we get into any of the soul parts and that. What would you say to that? Would you say that
maybe. I don't know, you know. One of the parts is like we just don't know what it would be like. So, mm-hmm. but like what would it be like to have your brain swapped out into another body? I kind of feel like I would be a very different person, and that's because like my brain is obviously always interacting with my body. In fact, the way I feel about things, like when you like study like emotions and things, the way you feel isn't just a matter of like your brain chemistry. It's actually about like your body sending stimuli, and then your brain responds in certain ways and interprets them. And like put that in a slightly different body that doesn't send like those same stimuli. Does it get to like function in the same way? You know, are you going to have the same characteristics? Maybe you have all your memories, but I mean, you could imagine, is that enough to guarantee it? Like I genuinely don't know. But I mean, about the, like one of the examples you brought up, Austin, I mean, imagine, in Star Trek, right, the teleporter, they get into a teleporter, it breaks them down into molecules, right, or into atoms or whatever, and then it kind of reassembles a bunch of atoms in another place, kind of perfectly, you know, replicating. I kind of feel like they murder themselves every single time they go into the every time they go into the teleporter, and then just a perfect copy of Picard, you know, shows up on the planet, because all you've done is just create a perfect copy.
I think they've done an episode like that where the teleporter, like, it transported them, but it didn't atomize them in the first place. So it was like, I think they've done stuff on.
I'm sure.
And there's like a really famous book called Reasons and Persons by this philosopher named Derek Parfit, who uses that kind of example quite a bit. You know, we kind of feel like we can survive the teleporter. I don't know why we feel this way, but we do. But imagine the teleporter malfunctions, and then you've got yourself on Mars and yourself on Earth. You know, here's the question, like, I mean, like, make the question more human. Which one of you is married to your wife, right? which one of you gets access to your bank account, right? Like, right. And it seems like, it feels like that person on Mars, whoever they are, is going to feel equally like they have a strong claim to it, in a way. Mm-hmm. And yet, in those cases, I think our intuitions often go to say, it's probably the original person, right? But I mean, I don't know. Are those reliable? I don't know. I feel like what we're doing is just like raising a bunch of problems over and over, but saying like, it's a really hard issue. It's like really difficult to figure out. And one of the things that I like so much about reading science fiction, like as a philosopher, is the fact that it gives you like a bunch of weird cases to think about. And it gives you a bunch of weird sort of thought experiments to run through.
What would you say to purely the physicality argument? And just we're sticking in that lens. I would think the idea of identity when it comes to your body has something to do with function. Where, to bring the teleporter example of, if we still consider that person you're atomized, it's a new body, but it's identical in every way. Functionality, you function the same. Versus if you put me in a different, my brain in a different body.
Preferably like, Dwayne Johnson's or something like very...
Preferably Dwayne Johnson, yeah. Yes. My function would be different. I would have different body mass. My body would be reacting to stimuli in a different way where it is now functionally different.
Can I add on to one thing there? So we're talking about the very first sci-fi book ever, Frankenstein. Well, what is known as the first sci-fi book, what's generally agreed upon. And but have you ever seen or read Poor Things, Jared?
I have not, no.
Okay, this would be, because Poor Things has this similar concept where, again, putting your function, talking about what would you do in a different body. Poor Things is a book turned into a movie where it's inspired from Frankenstein, and Emma Stone plays this character where a mad scientist takes the brain of a mother and puts it into her unborn child's head. And then the unborn child has the brain of her mother, but in this unfunctional body, and has to redevelop, and essentially putting this really creepy dystopian thought experiment into play. And just kind of wanted to tag onto that, like the entire thing you're talking about, what sci-fi does so well is it puts these insane scenarios and makes you ask a lot of questions. But that point that you had to Jared about functionality, what do you think about Rich's point there?
Well, I mean, the thing we have to think about that is like, yeah, but like Rich, like currently, like your body mass and like how you react to stimuli and stuff, it's important right now, but it's also variable, right? Mm-hmm. I saw you guys' merch stuff. Like you're hitting the gym, like your body mass is gonna be different, right? Yeah. You know, you're changing your body composition, and like, you take like enough steroids or something, does that make you a different person? You know, like this is, mm-hmm. I mean, you really have to wonder, because like your function is variable, and for some reason we seem to think that like gradual change is acceptable for like the preservation of identity for a person, but like sudden dramatic change isn't, right? That's weird, and it's gonna get weirder when you go into the sci-fi realm. But also just think, like, it's not out of the realm of possibility, you know, in some near future where it'd be really possible for you in a day to get a kind of surgery or something like this that like totally changed your body composition, right? Mm-hmm. Just like radically altered like what your body is like and how you feel about things and stuff. And I think then you have to actually directly wrestle with the question of like, what are you doing to yourself? Or is it even sort of yourself at the end of the process, right?
Yeah.
If you can dramatically change yourself that much, that quickly. And yeah. Also just like, why do we care about the rate of change? Why do we care about the rate of change? I don't know. I'm just kind of reporting all of my sort of gut feelings about it after considering some cases. But it's not even like my most considered opinion.
Yeah, part of our thumbnail here has you, or it has one side with someone with a phone and another with cyborgs. And we kind of have that as an example in the thumbnail, because that rate of change you're talking about, where can yourself, your function, even be an extension of thyself? Our phones, does that become part of ourselves? Because it's so much part of our function. Well,
our memory, our thoughts, our computation on how our brains work, working with our technology. How much are we taking our brain, putting it into a machine, and is now that part of us?
Have you ever heard of the extended mind hypothesis? No. It's sort of a philosophical thing in the philosophy of mind.
Briefly, it was by love
David Chalmers and another cognitive scientist whose name I can't recall. I feel a little bad because it's not just Chalmers, but these two basically posit that cognition, right, does not just kind of take place in the head; it takes place in the environment as well. Mm. And as you build these sort of stable connections between certain objects in your environment, they just are part of your cognitive load, or like your cognitive equipment. And in some way, they are a part of your mind. Your mind is sort of extended to the things that you use on a regular basis. It's not like, but at the same time, that also means your cognition can be kind of malleable, because like pencil and paper is not like always the thing you use for multiplication and stuff, but it's like this thing that you can kind of bring into your mind, use for a bit. And you can do, I imagine, you can do a lot harder math using a pencil and paper than you can in your head.
Oh, yeah.
That's almost a bold assumption. Bold assumption.
Well, it's almost certainly true, because I think most people, there's like a pretty well-studied limit on the number of digits, for instance, that most humans can even remember when they're doing math in their heads. And it's like 9, or you know, some kind of what it would seem like an arbitrary number, but it's
why cell phone numbers are what there. Usually 7 to, yeah. So we can remember 3. Yeah, if they were like 15, 4,
right, it'd be very, very hard. But then also, okay, there's that, but then imagine that you have this thing that you carry with you literally at all times, and that you feel anxious about if you can't find it. Like, I don't know where I put my phone. I'm suddenly like, where the hell is it? Right. And it has, I don't know my wife's phone number in some sense of like just in my head. I don't, because I've never not had my cell phone. when I've known her, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just, it's in my phone. That's how I know her. So they say, do you know your number? I'm like, yeah, let me call her. And I just pull out my phone. It has my calendar on it. I don't have to remember dates, right? So it's a bunch of like cognitive offloading. Now, what one interesting kind of consequence of the extended mind hypothesis is actually that other people are also part of your consciousness.
I don't like that thought.
And this is like such a thing if you get married. I swear, like, are either of you married or in like super long-term relationships or anything like that?
I'm not, no.
Your relationship.
Okay, so look, the longer you are like with someone, right? There's going to be like the person who remembers birthdays, and there's going to be like the person who remembers where all of the kitchen utensils are. Ideally, it should not always be the same person, by the way, you know, like, but like, you know, and it's going to be like the person who remembers this, and to the point where like the two of you just ask each other all the time for like information. That's
such a good point.
And you sort of understood as a couple know a lot more than you understood. Mm-hmm. As an individual. And the extended mind hypothesis goes on to say that like you literally do know all that stuff you have to ask your spouse about if they're sort of part of this stable connection. And I think that's super interesting too, because I think it kind of questions how much you can ever think about like us being purely pure individuals, right?
Like a hive mind. Like purely, there's alien creatures in sci-fi books where and animals that have a hive mind, and how much is that connected, where they actually share their thoughts telepathically with each other, and that whole direction that you're going, is that shared mind hypothesis, what's their conclusion? Are they trying, what is their, what are the consequences or the benefits to that?
Well, so the way that they kind of gets framed is just like, this is just a different way of thinking about consciousness you like take in a bunch of all this other stuff. And, you know, here's the sort of theoretical work it can do or whatever. And I'm sure it's been sort of debated much more thoroughly in the philosophy of science or philosophy of mind literature in a way that I kind of never followed up on. I just kind of think like the initial idea is super interesting. But I mean, let's actually, okay, one thing I think we've done kind of a bad job on, so I'm gonna criticize all of us in this call, is that we have not used a ton of examples. You guys have talked about Frankenstein and Poor Things, but it's like helpful to use more examples, right, to talk Definitely. Through any of these yes, issues. Yes. Okay, so here's like a classic science fiction example. But am I allowed to like give spoilers to a book that like everyone should have read like 15 years ago? Or
which book is that?
It's Ender's Game.
Oh, you know what?
We'll allow it.
We'll allow it, but hey, skip 1 minute if you don't want to be spoiled for Ender's Game.
It's Ender's Game, though. Yeah. Come on.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the fundamental sort of thing that we find out, the tragedy of Ender's Game, mm-hmm. is that the buggers didn't know.
Yep.
Like, the buggers didn't know that, because they couldn't imagine what consciousness was like as individuals. So they thought we were just like, they think human beings are just like automata or whatever, right? And then when you go to Speaker for the Dead, it's like the same kind of thing. Like the piggies like can't understand why a male wouldn't want to be sort of turned into a tree, essentially, right? And they don't understand it. It's like super gruesome. And that whole, like, I've only read the first two books, actually. I don't know why I never continued. But the early parts of that series are really about, how do you possibly communicate across those giant cognitive differences?
Right.
Like, you struggle probably with cultural differences. Like, you meet someone who's like grew up in a completely different culture than you, and you have all kinds of weird miscommunications sometimes, right? It's just a fact of life. Now imagine they have a completely different cognitive architecture and they have a completely different way of conceiving who a person is. And so like, how can the buggers like ever truly understand what it means to be a human? And similarly, how can a human ever like truly understand what it is to be a bugger, right? That's kind of like that's why the ending of Ender's Game is so sad.
I do want to take this moment just as an aside for people watching and know. This exact conversation is what the Sun Eater series is actually fundamentally about and deals a lot with. Please read the second book.
We have a guest. Can you not bully me? Let's just be a little kinder. Oh, no, it's just
I need to be.
You should read the second book, man. You should be reading the second book. I don't know what the hell's wrong with you, man. The guest joins
in the bullying.
Have you read the Sun Eater series?
Yeah, I've read. Well, I haven't read all. I'm not completely caught up, but I'm pretty far along. Okay. I've read the novellas that I'm supposed to at this stage, and I've read the first three books, and then I'm sort of like pacing myself. I know Disquiet Gods just came out. I need to finish. By the end of the summer, I think I'm going to be done. I just got a lot of other stuff I'm reading. Yeah,
I will That's be fair. Doing I'm Howling Dark soon.
I'm also just, on the. Yeah. I've read up to the third book as well.
Okay. Yeah. So I mean,
I have two series to finish. Then I'll get to it. Yeah.
huge mass of this stuff is like in Sun Eater. Just speaking very vaguely, is this question of like, what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to encounter an alien species that just does not accept our norms and our way of like thinking about the world? Right. Mm-hmm. That's what the Pale are like. But also kind of internally to the Sun Eater. Oh, man, Austin, I wish you had read it. It's just like also it kind of deconstructs what it means to be human within human society as well. There's mm-hmm. There's a bunch of stuff like that in a way that I think is really, really interesting. But we can't say anything. Now, yeah. So I'll just grimace for a moment.
just wanted to poke the bear to prod you to read
Jared,
more.
Jared, you said at the beginning that he was the quiet, angry one. You were correct. Yeah. It's not poke the bear, okay?
but Sun Eater's great. Sun Eater's great. I think, I for the record, I think Christopher Rocchio is like one of the greats right now. Like he's doing great work.
Completely agree.
I don't get excited about a lot of modern authors. I don't tend to follow releases super closely or anything like that. There's only like a couple authors that I follow, and Christopher is one of them. Yeah, he rules.
That's awesome.
Well, when he finally gets to those books, we'll have to bring him back on.
Part two. For that.
Just a deep dive into Sun Eater.
Yeah. And I got a shout out to Mike's book reviews because he was the one who turned me on to that. I think he turned on like a ton of people.
He was the catalyst for how not that Rocchio didn't do it on his own, but he was the BookTube catalyst. I think he was talking about these books years ago.
Rocchio yeah. says this. Rocchio in one of the books says like he dedicates it to Mike and BookTube who saved the series. So like Rocchio admits this too. Like
it's fully aware. Yeah, you had a point there. Yeah. You're gonna go on something.
Oh no, we're just talking about the idea of cultural and breakdown. Mm-hmm. A lot of sci-fi deals with just alien cultures and not just what makes us different from humans, but why and how different species interact with the world and their stimuli of imagine a species that doesn't have hearing. How do they go about, how do they operate in the world? And there's things that they just won't never understand. Same thing with consciousness of if, you know, a hive mind doesn't understand the idea of individuality within their own person. That's kind of the stuff that I love with sci-fi that a bunch of different series do.
So something that you should a paper you should read. I mean, I don't know how many people are going to go read philosophy papers because of this. There's this great paper by this guy named Thomas Nagel, who wrote this fantastic little paper called "What's It Like to Be a Bat," and it kind of argues that it's in principle impossible for us to understand what it's like to be a bat. We can understand what it's like to be a human imagining to be a bat. Or what it's like to be a human temporarily experiencing being a bat, but it's like, what is it like to be a bat, right? Where echolocation is the way that you see yourself, see the world. Mm-hmm. And you can imagine like a dolphin, if they were trying to imagine what a human is like, would see us as like radically impoverished because we can't echolocate either.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of a two-way street in this direction because like, you turn off the lights, we can't see anything. Bats are fine, right? And so there are... These radical barriers for us to be able to understand each other. And I think that's part of the problem. I mean, in a series like Sun Eater, they make it more about morals a lot of the time. So they understand the world so differently. So like what they think they're doing just fine, right? Or they don't think they're doing anything wrong. And so we can't reason with them in that way. That's a possibility. But there's also just these like physical sort of natural features of the way that we interact with the world, which then I think really does open up this thing like of what happens in, you know, some distant future where humanity decides to like bifurcate and you've got like the people who upload their consciousness and you've got the people who like don't, right? How long does it take before like this is just essentially two different species who can't even like remember what it was like to communicate with each other? Because the first generation, I don't know, their hard drives freeze or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then it's like their children on their new hard drives are doing just fine. But they wouldn't ever remember what it's like to have been human either, right? So they'd be like purely these consciousnesses on like, you know, just in the thought experiment.
Matrix how long does it take them to then, example of
yeah, how long that. Does it take for them to then look back and say, you know, what is, I mean, we share some history with humans, but like we are fundamentally different things.
Well, I think this brings up a more difficult question. It's something that I think a lot of great examples, and when you're trying to explain a concept, it's almost, it is a good way to explain it by going to the extremes. And to make a point in the extreme brings some clarity to a more nuanced position. When we're talking about different species and how they live completely different lives with functionally different brains and stimuli and modes of interacting with the world, we shrink that down to us here on this planet. I think there's a lot of different aspects of, are we the same humans even 200 years ago, 100 years ago, of different beings that have operate in the world in completely different ways that mm-hmm. had different memories that we don't understand what it would be like to be someone from 500 years ago? And
yeah, so I mean, imagine, cultures. You know, I know that if I had been born 500 years ago, right, with like my biological makeup, I'd be fine, right? That's except I wouldn't be fine because I don't think glasses were sort of readily available, so I'd be screwed. But I would be able to kind of make do. But as I am now, sort of enculturated in this, in sort of this world, if I went back 500 years into the past, I feel like I'd go nuts, right? I feel like, all these things that I take for granted suddenly become inconveniences. All these things that I never have to think about are things I have to think about all the time. And similarly, you could imagine, it's kind of like in Brave New World, right? You could, is the name John, the sort of kid who grows up on like the nature preserve or something?
I believe so.
Okay. Well, he...
terrible with names.
He comes into like sort of the Brave New World, the sort of strange, highly engineered world out of the sort of nature preserve. And he's like overwhelmed. Like he can't handle it, right? I mean, to the point where it's like he drives him to despair and he kills himself. But I tried to make that quick so you guys wouldn't get a little yellow dollar sign next to your video. But he can't handle it. And I actually think I remember, you guys remember, this isn't science fiction, you guys remember the Hatchet books? Do you ever read these books?
No.
The Hatchet books. But like a kid, oh my gosh, these were like, when I was a kid, these were like the books to read.
The Hatchet books.
Yeah, so it's about like a kid who is involved in like a plane crash when he's like really young, and he gets like stranded in like the mountains on his own. Yeah. And it's basically like he has to like learn how to survive. Got right? It. And he has to like, and so he has to, and so it's totally like a, and it's a very, very funny series in one way, because like at the end of the book, the first book, he gets found and rescued and he like does fine. And then like the second book is like, but what if he hadn't gotten rescued and had to survive the winter? Because like obviously the author just like wanted to keep writing. Yeah, yeah. I think she like realized
they dropped him back off.
Yeah, yeah. She like realized crash. Like she had a cash cow on her hand and like, she's like, okay, we gotta do this, right? Yeah. I think the second one's called like Brian's Winter or something like that. But anyway, that I think there's like this scene where like he goes back and he like goes to a mall after being in the woods by himself for like months and months, and he like almost passes out because it's too loud. Right. He just like can't handle the stimulus anymore. Speaking of major cultural differences, I feel like talking to two sort of bookish guys that haven't read these books that were like such a big part of my childhood, I feel like I'm talking to two space aliens.
We don't even understand each other at this point.
Yeah, this is too much.
I'm trying to connect the idea about gradual change of humanity itself over, hundreds of years. We consider it all humanity. But if you took someone from 500 years ago and plopped them here today, that sudden change of both internally their moral consistency, how they interact with the world, their memories, and all that included, that sudden change, are they no longer our version of human? Would they be a different type of human being?
Yeah, we don't even have to go back, I don't think. The uncontacted tribes today of like the, I just looked up the name, it's the Sentinelese, I believe it was, that if you have ever seen those videos where it's people on boats interacting with this uncontacted tribe for hundreds of years, and right mm-hmm. there, that's just a thousands of years technological difference. And but just take that example of what we're saying, and Jared, you were going, hey, 500 years ago, how would you fare, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, look, so in one important sense, they are, right? Like, because, like, we have, like, sort of basic respect for them, right? We, like, think that they have human rights and things like this. Sure. And so, like, that's an important part of the conversation. But they are, like, also just incredibly different than us to the point where we even view it as, like, at least some people would, and I'm kind of inclined to this, that there's almost, like, a moral imperative not to disrupt their lives, right? Because if we disrupt their lives, like if we find an uncontacted tribe, we win that encounter, right? It's our culture that becomes sort of dominates there. They have cell phones in 6 months, and so it's like we
honestly they're doing better off than us without technology.
So the thought is actually like you have to be. It's sort of like the prime directive in that sense, right? Mm-hmm. Like you wait for as soon as the species develops warp drive, then they're fair game to contact because they're going to contact everybody, right? But you know, you don't sort of take the first step. But to say this, like, yeah, so I do think like it's important to acknowledge like they are the same in the sense here. Like you don't want to go a little too far. I don't think either of you were going here, right? I'm just like flagging thing here. When you start like, well, are they even really human as we mean it? Well, that like that way danger lies if you go a little too far and you're like, well, we could, sure. You know, we could round them up and sell them or something. You know, like that's the kind of stuff we don't want to say. Right. But the
which is how it was justified in history. I mean, seeing
often, right? They're like subhuman, prehuman, pre-civilized, these sorts of things. But the second, but to also acknowledge like the very real differences, including in how they see the world. But it's not even due to cultural differences that are like due to like being disconnected, right? There are certain tribes in Australia, for instance, right, who they have this tremendous sense of direction. So in their language, they don't use left, right, forward, backward. They always use cardinal directions. And they have like really fine-grained ways of saying like this much northeast. They don't say north and east, obviously, but they have some sense, right, of objective directions. And to the point where I believe these were consensual experiments. You know, you would like put them in a truck, put them like blindfold them, drive them around a bunch of places and stuff like this, and then say like, what direction are you facing? And they'll just like get it in one. Like they'll just always know.
Dang.
Right? Now, that is like a skill that probably they pick up over time being enculturated in this tribe where it's just a normal thing and also in the way that they speak. And they don't have this kind of convenient shorthand that we do about left and right. But I mean, how inconvenient actually is left and right? Like, because do you mean my left? Is it stage left? You know, like we made this nice simplification and then we lost something because we made that simplification. And so like already there, that's like a skill. Some people could develop that skill, but as far as I understand, like everyone in these tribes has that skill. That they're able to hear, and like that's just something that most of us don't have, in the same way that your parents or your grandparents probably have like a bunch of phone numbers memorized. Maybe it's like degraded slightly as they've gotten older or something like this. Mm-hmm. But like, how many phone numbers like do you think you have memorized?
I think I really only have like maybe five, and that was because before I had
you had to call mom, dad, and
yeah, before I had a cell phone. I had to memorize the numbers if I wanted to call somebody.
And yeah,
I still have those numbers memorized.
Yeah,
I think I have like two memorized still, and one of them is my own cell phone. Like, I have like even completely forgotten like my childhood phone numbers because like I think like my memory for that stuff is just completely shot. I've just completely given up on it, and it doesn't bother me at all because I never need to know these things. Sure. But it's just like sort of weird to think like, is that my childhood number? I don't know. But like, I know when I was young, before I had a cell phone, I had my grandparents' phone number memorized because I love to call them on the weekends, right? You know, but I don't have that anymore.
And that capacity for us to remember how much and how much do we extend it to our phones or to whatever technology, that's another thing about humanity is not to segregate this to just, okay, only people that can remember have so much intelligence. Does that make you human? Because even the when we're talking about biological makeup, and again making the clear distinction that, you know, let's talk about human rights, because what makes human, we could talk about human rights and narrow it down into the more moral framework, where regardless of your intelligence, you still have inalienable human rights. I mean,
go ahead. To that point, when we're talking about the uncontacted tribes, there's that interesting gray area of, we acknowledge, especially they are human, of course, deserve human rights and all this aspect, except for there is the case where this one, you know, stupid traveler, they go over and they're trying to take pictures of them. And I believe one of them got killed with a bow and arrow. No one went, there was no accountability per se for that murder.
Yeah.
Because there's a difference of, we don't believe that they're necessarily accountable for it because they,
we look at their perspective of a different culture.
Try to go like the sort of sovereign nation route, right? Like they're their own nation. They decide who comes in or something like this. Someone tries to contact them. They say no. They shoot them. Right. Cool. It's their prerogative. But like if Canada started doing that to like Americans who just.
Save big money on your next project now at Menards. Brighten up your garage or workspaces with LED utility and panel light bulbs from GT Light. GT Light light bulbs are energy efficient, and with their easy adjustable light panels, you can direct light where you need it most. Save big on all GT industrial utility and panel light bulbs. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer for more hot deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Yeah.
And sort of more grace in this case, we seem to like there's less accountability. And I think it's there because we just recognize the very different positions that we occupy. Mm-hmm. And it's not just like a position of power or whatever. It's not like this. It's that like they are coming from a very, very different kind of perspective. There's conception of germs as, right, or infections. Oh, sure. But like it is usually not a good idea. Like world travelers are exposed to more bacteria. We carry around all this bacteria and stuff from around the world, right? And we slowly get more and more risk that comes to it too, even if they are not totally conscious of that fact. We seem to like say, well, actually, it makes a lot of sense that they'd want to do this. And we sort of extend a lot of forgiveness, I would say.
It definitely seems like as a species, we can be very specious. Like, hey, anybody that has the DNA that's human gets human rights. There's a lot of gray areas of, hey, there wasn't an accountability here because you have to look at the perspective of an uncontacted tribe, as you're saying about the germs and bacteria, that we have to be conscious of treating things with more grace, treating people with more grace than other situations. And
to be accountable, you have to have some degree of consciousness about your actions, on why it was wrong. Or we have between the US and Canada, we have a degree of understanding that the Canadians are conscious about shooting an American on the border that tries to enter. That's why they're accountable. Because
maybe not always
conscious.
Though, because like then let's take the example of like a 3-year-old who commits murder. But then we get into a very what is just. Like,
generally, that's exactly how the legal system breaks down of a minor. Generally, they are not held to the same accountability standard because
they're still accountable, but to what extent?
I think that it applies the same thing to the uncontacted tribes. Is they are not as conscious of their
wrongdoing.
They're not in the same way that we are.
I don't know if it's that. I actually don't know if it's them being conscious of it, right? Because it might even just be that in their perspective, or actually based on like the facts that they sort of can take for granted, it's like this.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And who's just like hanging out too close to the Canadian border, is that like there's no threat involved, right?
Yeah.
If you live in like small tribes or whatever, random strangers who are appearing, who are like loud and brightly dressed or whatever, the default assumption that they're people are allowed to preserve themselves and are left to defend themselves. You know,
I just wanted to clarify. It was consciousness of it being wrong. Is kind of
yeah. But I mean, I even think there, like, they might have really strong norms against murder, right? Mm-hmm. But like for them,
sure. Mm-hmm.
Very blurry, and we have different laws, different cultures draw these lines to different areas. If you live in a case like, I would say this, we take a certain amount of security for ourselves for granted, right?
Mm-hmm.
Living in a fairly stable society. If you're living kind of in a much less sort of that you need to avoid like a lot more, right? So, it's just, you know, there's a lot of nuance there. But if I can ask you guys a question here, like when you think about science fiction specifically, right, that makes you question what it means to be human, like what are the series or books or whatever that you actually think about? Like what are the ones that come to your mind?
One that comes to mind, I didn't read the novel that turned into this, but Blade Runner is a great example, but also All Systems Red deals with a similar thing, and I kind of like the more quirkiness of something like Martha Wells' All Systems Red. Which, have you read that series by Martha Wells?
I am the only person in the world who hates Murderbot.
Dang.
Like, I read All Systems Red and was like, wow, I can't believe people like this.
Oh, aww. Dang. Okay, well, there goes my example.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry, but I read it, and I was so thoroughly, like, just, I was not overwhelmed. I was not underwhelmed. I was purely whelmed, you might say. I felt nothing while reading that book.
The reason I liked it, without spoiling the book, is I think just for the science fiction conversation, is we took this in a very, we were going, there's a lot of directions we can go with what makes human, but All Systems Red just gives a very empathetic robot. And showing, hey, if a robot can be as empathetic and charming and fun and you can relate to the robot more than you can relate to the humans in the story, just gets to that question we're getting at of, hey, what does make us human? Is it just ability to conversate, empathize? Is it ability to relate? If I can relate to this object, a robot, a thing, more than I can to person, and then and that's what the question of Blade Runner is getting at as well. Well, a bit differently, but with Blade Runner's getting more into...
In the book, they actually use it a little more explicitly. Like, the ability to feel empathy is how they tell a replicant apart from a human.
Got it. Mm-hmm. Didn't know that.
And then, the fact that actually there seem to be replicants that can feel empathy kind of throws that for a loop, right? Like, that's the incredibly convincing copies, right?
Yeah.
And this is actually what I think the sort of spiritual sequel to Blade Runner, was it 2049 or whatever, that I thought handled really well, actually. Yeah.
The reason that stuff interests me is because when we're talking about human rights and when it comes down to morality and empathy, that conversation I like almost more than all the others, because morality and empathy of a human, we can kind of look at, we don't have to look at aliens in outer space to see who we contact. We can just look at us versus animals. We kind of brushed on this earlier when you were talking about a dolphin or a bat, but I love talking to vegans. I find it so, because vegans can have a very moral principle that makes complete sense under all the principles they have. So it's extending the question to what rights do humans have versus what rights do animals have. And that conversation also fascinates me, because if I could relate to a robot and think, hey, don't kill that murder bot robot because I feel a certain way, why can't I feel the same thing for a puppy? Why do I value a puppy versus a pig? Is it just because one's cute and we've over culture bonded with dogs more? And so that whole conversation. But before we go on all that, the same question for you, Rich, that you was asking, like a certain book series for you, and do you, what conversation around that sci-fi topic do you like?
Oh, for me, I mean, mainly Neuromancer is probably one of the bigger ones for me. The whole cyberpunk genre in general.
That is interesting.
But everything with that book makes me realize why cyberpunk for me is my horror genre.
Yeah.
In that book has... Have you read the book, Jared?
Yeah, I've read Neuromancer. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, dealing with alienation from your body, we have the silicone brain of you know, a person's mind uploaded into the computer? What are their thoughts on that existence? And gives some interesting qualities of, makes me freak out a little bit, but then how much do you replace of your body parts? And yeah,
that's, and the way actually the main character near the beginning of that book, right, feels disconnected from the world because he can no longer be connected to sort of the net, right? You know, it's a very interesting fact about him, because this thing that's actually a totally normal human condition, not being able, like for us, right, not being able to upload yourself or like sort of experience information directly in your mind, for him is like this great impairment that practically makes life not living, or it, like not worth living.
It's a similar position of to that main character. It is a similar position of being severely debilitated in some way that we would feel a different way if all of our limbs were removed. The way we interact with the world, we would feel like we're so hindered.
Yeah.
And same thing with Case. But I think it's actually, by the end of that book, is a good positive message on change and being able to interact with the world in different ways and being able to appreciate some. Ultimately, it's not a negative book of, oh, well, you can't access the internet, well, I guess your life isn't worth living. I don't want to spoil the ending, but it does have a positive.
You guys should only read the same books. Like, the two of you should only have read the same book. Like, you know, because I want to think of you as a collective. And so, like,
we struggled with that to some degree. And we eventually just had to split and go, like, we're just going to read what we want, and I'm going to bug each other if
but the thing book's is important. When I read Neuromancer, I appreciated the thought provokingness of it, but I just didn't like it as a novel. But I do get that I'm just not a cyberpunk fan, so I get the whole thing. Cyberpunk, it's a big horror genre, especially because it's just cynical, depressing, and my biggest fear for humanity is that cell phones are stage one. I love cell phones. They're great. I mean, what are we going to do, live without them? But the certain level, they're also horrible, but the level of science fiction we're going to get it to is when we're going to start enhancing our brains, and when we're going to start to need, you will be at a significant disadvantage from other humans. When we're talking about this whole Matrix thing with in Neuromancer, you will be at a disadvantage if you're not part of the net, if you don't have some sort of enhanced brain or steroid usage that becomes to whatever the next steroid is, where everybody has to be enhancing their body, or else they don't think as quickly. They can't look up on Wikipedia instantly. But that kind of concept for that, I'm sure you're interested in too, Rich. Jared, that concept of when humans start to go down that rabbit hole of getting more and more and more connected to technology.
Or machine.
Yeah. That actually, by the way, is also another great theme of Sun Eater. So you should really,
it also is. Great point, Jared. Great point.
You know, how long have you guys been like talking about books together and stuff? Both like on the podcast, but like as friends.
3-4 years?
Yeah, close to.
Okay, so when I talked about being in like a long-term relationship where you like offload knowledge on each other, like the two of you totally are modeling this.
Oh, actually. 100%.
You're like, like the two to ramble collective.
Exactly. Like whenever he wants to know what to think, I just tell him.
You got your cyberpunk guy, you got your Red Rising guy or whatever, you know? So this, I think this is actually, it's perfect. You actually understand exactly what it's like.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. Hey, with just YouTube functionality, I show my face and keep my presence. And he does the YouTube upload, the editing, all that stuff, and keeping track of the calendar. It's a very equal and fair balance.
Actually, the thing that this would be is when we were toying with technology stuff, I'm like, it's kind of like asking where you put the towel. Like, where do you store the towels in your pantry to you and your wife? That would be me to Rich of, hey, how do you do the thing with the camera? And then Rich to me of like, hey, is the video uploaded like yesterday? Are we on track? So we have the different compartments in our head that create two to ramble in a way. So you're totally right.
Yeah. So you guys are already like a sort of proto hive mind.
Precisely.
And like you just need like both to get Neuralinks so you can just bicker back and forth silently about, you know, should you go to 3 uploads a week instead of two or something.
I don't mean to transfer us into more culture related to humanity, but this whole,
whatever you want.
I mean, we recently read American Gods. It just had me reeling and thinking a lot recently.
Okay. Yeah. Bless you.
And thank you. One thing about this collective hive mind that interests me too is America is generalizing America's more individualistic culture versus other cultures can be more community and family oriented. Not to say America isn't and that families aren't here. It's just the model.
It's a nice generalization. Yeah,
just that generalization of seeing how even this whole conversation we're having about a hive mind, or can there be a sort of collective conscious, and you don't just, you and your phone share certain information, and you and a friend and you and a partner, but maybe we have a different frame of it just because of the culture we're in too, where I didn't think of that as an initial conversation to have. I was thinking in my head, robots and us versus animals. So this is a whole path I didn't think this would go down, just because I guess my bias here of thinking like, oh, of course I'm me, nobody else is me, right? But even cutting that barrier and going, hey, what if you and your family as a unit, some families, at least in America, where it's more traditional to after college move out. Plenty can't today, especially because housing prices, getting into the whole economics of things. But in other cultures, it's way more normal to stick with your family and live in the same house and share things longer, which I can see as being a collective mind more so, or not that you're all in groupthink, but just that there's more people in the mind, mm-hmm. In the hive mind. Yeah,
we're talking about this. We've talked a lot about the positive aspects of stable connections enabling a sort of hive mind even today.
Mm-hmm.
But Jared, from a more philosophical point of view, are there philosophers or other great thinkers that thought about more of the negative aspects, or what are the drawbacks to these stable connections in our thinking?
Yeah, yeah, okay. So I don't know of great thinkers, but I can tell you my own thoughts.
Okay.
You're a good thinker. We'll give you that.
Which I genuinely worry about, actually, is that like for like some things, I don't really care that I've lost the capacity to do them, because I feel like I could probably train myself to memorize like 10 phone numbers in an afternoon if I like wanted to spend the time, right? But I do kind of wonder if by sort of forming these like long-term sort of dependencies on technology, we kind of make ourselves just less good at reasoning and thinking on our own, right? So people who weren't allowed to use calculators in high school math, which used to be a thing, right? They didn't always just make you buy a graphing calculator, can do a lot more math kind of in their head or on paper than people who bought the calculators, right? And there might be people who drive stick and have never drove an automatic kind of got a feel for the car in a way that nobody people who've only driven automatics just kind of don't have. And I do kind of wonder what that leaves us if the connections kind of break down, right? So, all right, you're in the woods and your cell phone dies and you don't have connection for a week, right? Well, you're probably used to, you see what a tree looks like, or you see some mushrooms and you like want to know, do they look good or not? Your response right now is to like take a picture, put it on an app, right? Or to like Google it or something like that. That's not available to you anymore. You just have never had to develop any of those kind of skills. But also, more fundamentally, like, has the ability to always be able to like get a quick answer with this thing that you carry around in your pocket, or eventually this thing that's like sort of implanted in your head or that you wear on your glasses. You know, does that actually just make you worse at being human, so to speak? So that if it were gone, you would be functioning at a level that we would almost consider kind of sad. Like it's sort of sad or even like a little bit pathetic that you wouldn't be able to handle these things on your own. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is a sad case, right, to think about, because we talked about these like people, right, being, well, like what oftentimes like in a couple that's been together for a very, very long time, if one of them dies and they've been together for decades or something, it's not just like incredibly emotionally hard on the person who survives. It's also very like cognitively hard, because suddenly all those things that like their spouse used to do for them or used to kind of handle is now part of their cognitive load again. And they've never had to like live in this house by themselves and know where everything everything is. And I think with human beings, other humans, it's just inevitable that we are going to form those kind of dependencies. It's just this, and it's sort of the tragedy of falling in love, right? Is that eventually you will also, one of you will suffer like that. But with technology, it's optional. We can choose to live this way or not, right? And I do think we need to be a little more deliberate about saying, do I want to choose to enter into this kind of relationship in a way that could affect like who I am and what I'm capable of? And this can come in even really minor cases. You get used to having a Kindle. You want to read a new book. Pop it open. Buy it on Kindle. You know, charges your credit card. You don't even feel it until you see the bill at the end of the month. You know, and like you have a new book. Well, when I was a kid, right, you went to a library. And if the library didn't have it, you started asking the librarian if they would order it, right? And maybe a couple months later, you finally got the book. You know, and it totally changes your relationship to the media that you consume, for instance. And that's like such a minor thing. Consider that for basically everything that you handle, you know, your ability to quickly communicate with any person you want around the world, your ability to get any fact, right? There was like a comedian whose name I can't remember whose joke this is. I'm just acknowledging that it's like not my joke at all, who was just like, you know, when I was a kid, if you didn't know Tom Petty's birthday, you just didn't know Tom Petty's birthday. Like, and you just had to like learn to be okay living in a world where you didn't know Tom Petty's birthday. Like, that was just the thing that you would never know.
Yeah.
But, like, I, in some very loose sense, know Tom Petty's birthday because I could Google it in 15 seconds, right? And so, and that's just changed who we are. And, like, I think you have to think, at least think about, like, those consequences.
Hmm. Yeah, I've also thought to some degree, oh, going down this line, there's been some things I've read and thought about myself that gives me pause. Where on our channel, I've joked before about how I'm not a fan of the lab coats, and it's the idea of constantly bringing up studies in arguments, for specifically that reason of I've had it when going to college and trying to argue out a debate with somebody that the go-to is here is said study that agrees with what I'm exactly saying, just throwing studies at each other, which ultimately I think really hinders your cognitive thinking ability. Instead of actually, no, don't tell me some study said somewhere where you read that it agrees with you. Explain it to me. In your words, what did you think about it? How do you logic or rationalize this? Whether instead of just offloading your thinking ability to some lab coat somewhere did some study. It always bothers me, especially when both people haven't read the same study. And it's like, well, we're just talking back. We're just throwing studies at each other.
Because there's like a difference between being able to read someone's study and being able to integrate it into your argument, right? And being like, based on this, and like, we can look at this evidence, right? And go through like the patterns versus just like, look at the top line heading and say like, this was the finding, therefore, right? For one thing, summaries are often wrong. Another thing, many studies are wrong. Like just as like a matter of fact, huge numbers of like studies that are published are wrong. Academic publishing is not a great filter to guarantee truth. And so you still kind of have that responsibility. It's like part of being human that you have the responsibility of the person you're arguing with to like be able to give and state, give your reasons and ask for reasons from them. Right. You know, this is a kind of a term that gets thrown around in some areas of philosophy of like, sort of like when we're discussing things, we're kind of engaging in this game of giving and asking for reasons. And by reasons, we mean like reasons to believe things or reasons for why we did things. And part of being human is like, not only are you capable of doing that, but I sort of hold you accountable to doing that, right? And I want to say, Richard, like, why did you do that? And if you don't give me a satisfactory reason, I can kind of blame you for it, but I can also kind of demand more of you, or I can just like lower my estimation of you.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. that is the issue that you're both getting at. There's the cynical side of this is, do we lose that cognitive ability? Do we lose our deductive reason? Do we lose our rationale for why do we believe what we believe and just kind of siphoning off our explanations of things to outside sources? And that can be true for tying us back into a little bit of that hive mind too, or the collective thinking of, I will siphon off what I think to somebody else. Now, that can be good and bad. Good in that, does the person have more knowledge than you do? Because we do need to delegate. We can't just have all information in our heads infinitesimally. But also, what maybe you don't just listen to one person say this, but rather, what does the consensus generally think on subject, and then try to incorporate
reason. So it's nice to have specialists, right? It's nice to have people who know a lot about a little. And as long as you've got kind of a diverse group that can do that, right?
Of course, yeah.
It's probably good for you that Richard is the one who handles the cameras and Austin is the one that handles the uploads. And that if you tried to swap for a week, it would be chaos reigns, right? it would be bad. And that's not because either of you is particularly stupid. I mean, that's my impression at least.
I'm not even saying that. We both acknowledge our own stupidities.
Yeah. We acknowledge our intellectual failings.
Yeah.
But it's not either one of you is so unimpressive you couldn't learn to do the other thing. But it kind of just makes sense that one of you is the camera guy and one of you is the upload guy. Why would both of you kind of know how to do both? I mean, maybe if you really like having redundancies in your workflow or something, but it just doesn't make a ton of sense. You know, I've recently started to try to make my YouTube production a little smoother, because currently it's all in my head. All my ideas are in my head. All my scheduling is in my head. I'm terrible at organizing this stuff. But my wife's a calendar person. She's a calendar person. She's a spreadsheet person. And I'm oh, wait, this could be a partnership where you actually help me with this stuff, and you're actually part of the production in that sense, and it totally makes sense. And then I will never think about a calendar again.
Right. It's totally not free labor.
Or I'll just look. Well, I mean, you know, she's legally entitled to 50% of everything that I make. Right. But viewing it as this partnership actually allows us to both kind of do what we're good at. And, because I once asked her if she ever wanted to be on my YouTube channel, and she was I can think of nothing I would like less. this sounds horrendous. But, it just kind of makes sense to have people who sort of specialize. That part's there. The question we have to ask, though, is how much are you willing to give up, right, of yourself to this? I think it's a little bit weird when in a marriage, only one person ever cooks. There might be the one person who cooks more often, but if it's to the point where the other person can't cook a meal, I don't know. I just kind of view this as unless you've got some really good reason, you have some health condition that means you can never be near an open flame or something. it's kind of part of being an adult means you should know how to make spaghetti at least, you know, and so if you've gotten to the point where you can't even cook a meal at all, maybe you should try that out a little bit. But there's no reason why every single household task ever has to be divided 50-50. Now, in general, 50% of the work should be kind of – it's nice to share those things. But it shouldn't be I will do half of the laundry, and then you can do the other half of the laundry, and I will do half of
the meal. You stop folding the clothes halfway through.
Exactly. So, it's not – that would be a ridiculous way to do it.
Yeah.
So, some specialization, some sort of focus is totally normal. And we're going to see that also in our cognitive lives. We're going to see that, sort of in our collective sort of social lives and things like this. You know, Aristotle talks about this. Look, we've got people who are politicians. The politicians for Aristotle are in charge of organizing their city. So they're sort of kings of everybody, or they're sort of the master of all arts. But the politician shouldn't actually care all that much about the details of what it is to be raising horses. This is always one of Aristotle's examples. It's shipbuilding, horse training, and being a soldier. But, you know, the politician kind of needs to know what makes a good horse, but he shouldn't be involved in the day-to-day. How much do you feed the horse? How much hay do you feed the horse and stuff like this? Right. And also the politician doesn't even need to know, how do you prevent leaks in the ship, right? He just needs to make sure that the shipmaster does his job. And so there's enough kind of specialization there. And that's totally healthy. And in human societies, we see this. Not every YouTube channel needs to be about books. Not every YouTube channel needs to be about philosophy. There's going to be lots of YouTube channels that you like to watch that are about completely different things. It'd be weird if we all made 10% book content and 10%, I don't know, reaction content and, whatever it was. So that's fine. But there still needs to be that ability for you to develop your capacities as a human being, develop skills, basically, is what that's a fancy way of saying developing your own skills. And if you're never engaging in that, and if you use technology, to go back to this original question, because we're getting a little bit winding. We're all, like, winding through here.
We have named the channel appropriately. It's two yeah. to ra- it's now three to ramble. We yeah. always ramble here. There's never a focus. So,
but to go back to, like, the original question here, if you use technology to help you specialize a little bit, but you're still developing capacities, awesome. If you use technology to the point, always to the point where it just makes your life easier and it means you never have to, like, develop those other skills, mm-hmm. right? Or whatever, those higher skills that, like, that you'd like to focus on. If you never do that, then you've really kind of given up. And that's where I think your relationship to technology becomes rather unhealthy.
It's to add on to that, my fear, when we're talking about specialization, when collectively as us humans, other humans are specialized, that's one thing. I think it's far more appropriate. It's another thing when technology becomes the specialist. So there was a, it was a while ago. I think it was maybe 2 years ago-ish. There was an anonymous person from Google that uploaded basically an essay on some Substack, which, by the way, if you're enjoying listening to this, you should go ahead and subscribe to Jared's Substack here. It'll be linked down below or on the screen. Mr. Editor, somewhere here. But basically what he talked about is the people that are and now this is the claim that he said. I don't know how true this is, but to some degree I sort of believe it, that the people working at Google today could not create the original search engine, that those people are now gone, and that the work done now is with computer frameworks. And so it is always a system of patching where you're always building off of what came before, and they now have lost the fundamental way to build it again, that you're now through old code, and if it fundamentally breaks, they don't know a way to actually fix it anymore, because they have offloaded the knowledge to technology, that they are allowing a software framework to do the work that humans used to have to do.
Yeah. I mean, there are people who sort of code close to, like, bare metal, right?
Yeah.
And, like, sort of they understand, like, the mechanics of it. But even, like, then people who only work in, like, really higher abstract languages, which have, like, compilers in between, they don't have to understand those fundamental mechanics, right? And if we lived in a world where nobody ever did this, right, we somehow built it up and then no one ever knew how to, like, kind of program, like, as close to the metal as possible, then we'd be screwed, like, if things broke, right? Or it's really hard to build something new in that case. And I kind of worry about this. I mean, like, the kind of thing that's, like, looming over here, there's, like, a specter haunting this conversation, and that's, like, the question about, like, AI and stuff, right? I feel like this was, like, a little hotter, like, a year or two ago, to talk about how, like, it's going to replace all our jobs and stuff. Turns out that for, like, a bunch of cases, it's made a lot of people, like, way less productive. It's actually, like, been pretty bad for that stuff. But there just seems to be, like, a future case where maybe this could happen, where we offload so many kind of tasks that no one ever knows how to, like, do SQL anymore, right? Like, really basic stuff about, like, looking things up in databases. But on the other hand, like, it's really useful for people who don't need to know SQL to be able to, like, get a SQL query really quickly to, like, do something fast. Like, that seems good. But, like, the fact that no one ever has to learn how to do that stuff, and that's, like, a simple case, but then, like, add that on to, like, I don't know, do we no longer ever have to learn Python? Like, is that like, you know, our Python program is going to be a thing of the past in 5 years? And it seems like the more and more stuff that you kind of give up there, the more sort of responsibility also that you're giving up. You know, there's this old document from IBM, actually, that was kind of way ahead of its time. And it was about these, like, principles that the company was going to abide by. And one of them was that, like, a computer cannot be held responsible for a decision. And so, thus, a computer cannot make a decision that is important enough to be held responsible for. So, and it's this idea that basically, since you can't blame the computer, if there's, like, a life or death situation or a situation where it actually really matters, like, this is going to be a high consequence decision, the computer can't be the thing that makes the call. You always kind of have to have a human in the loop. This kind of comes up with, like, dilemmas about self-driving cars. Yep. You know, what happens if a self-driving car sees a pedestrian and it could swerve, but it would kill the driver in order to, like, save, I don't know, 5 pedestrians or something. So the numbers kind of check out by, like, a basic utilitarian calculus. But something feels weird about just, like, offloading that safety feature to an AI that gets to, like, make the call, too, because you can't blame it if it does wrong. You blame the people who make it, for instance, but
because that self-driving car doesn't have the same rights as the human. I'm going back to, hey, that self-driving car is that. Does that have the same value as a human?
Not just rights, but also responsibilities.
It's
not just rights, but also responsibilities. Mm-hmm. We don't seem to think that those things have responsibility to us, right? Mm-hmm.
But then
we still view them as tools.
If that car becomes more sentient in a way, if it builds empathy, if it starts to have more of a consciousness, and when AI, if it gets to that certain point where you almost can't distinguish it, at what point, then that's the whole conversation. But
at that point, I feel weird about using it to drive my car. Right.
Yeah.
Because like I feel like I have a car slave now, and I don't want to like have that.
So, as soon as you start defining that as a car slave, does that mean you see it as almost like equal in human rights? You know, like at what point do we start to get uncomfortable where if you are no longer willing to sit in the car, you no longer see it as an object. You see it as real.
Yeah. Even if you don't see it as like fully on a par with human beings, just viewing it as like person-like enough, right? You know,
even animals have rights, right?
There's like a spectrum. There's like a spectrum of it, right?
Well, even people who aren't vegans acknowledge. I think most people have animal rights, like beliefs of, hey,
don't torture
animals. If
there's some degree. And we seem to think that like we can do some things to other animals that's not okay to do to some mm-hmm. some others. By this I mean like, okay, some animals might be okay in captivity, right? It's like pretty messed up to keep a dolphin in captivity or to keep like an orca in captivity. They're like clearly social creatures. They need like some room. Like chimpanzees or like gorillas and things that are kept in captivity can like have basically symptoms of depression, you know? And so it seems like, okay, it's like one thing to have like a chinchilla enclosure where like they seem like they're having a lot of fun, but it's a bit different to have like a bunch of orangutans, right? Orangutans like are capable of using tools, for instance, which is like a hallmark of like intelligence. And you know, I think of sparrows as like particularly kind of dumb birds, but I think of like crows as like particularly brilliant birds who can also use tools and can collect things and can seem to form bonds. So we do seem to have some sort of a spectrum of beliefs already about non-human creatures.
Yeah, it seems like this whole conversation around what does science fiction define as humanity, what is a human? Bunch of sci-fi books explore it, and my favorite answer comes from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where, hey, we have the answer, it's 42, well, what the hell was the input? What are the right questions to ask? And that's all we're trying to figure out, because you put it perfectly at the beginning of, hey, we could start broad, get more specific, but really, we're meandering around asking more questions and seeing and determining, well, that whenever we cross that line of when a robot becomes human or when we meet another sentient being that distinguishes, you can't really distinguish, they have empathy, they have a consciousness, I guess we'll just know it when we see it, or we'll just keep asking more questions.
Well, it's the reason why the Turing test has already been passed. Like, the Turing test is no long, it's always fantasy, like, that's the stage that we know that technology is more like human, but well, now that's gone. it's a now bunk idea. It's now a bunk test for artificial intelligence. And so we just have to ask a better question.
If I had to pigeonhole both of you just to say one thing, like, hey, is there one thing we can tie down to? One thing you both can agree on here of what makes us human? What's an element? Not the definition, but what is a prerequisite? What would you have an answer for that, Jared or Rich?
Well, I mean, I think fundamentally the thing that makes us human is our ability to kind of engage in like social deliberation, right? So like, not just that we're able to like make rational on our own, but that like we are rational like with and to each other, to the point where we can like coordinate in really complex ways, including ways that mean like holding ourselves back sometimes for some greater good, or actually holding ourselves accountable. And so I think it's like entering into those kind of complex relationships of accountability and of support that actually it's going to be one essential feature of what it means to be human.
So the answer is this podcast was made us more human. I love that. except for when you didn't hold back about bullying me about Sun Eater. That happened multiple times. That was actually inhuman.
That was us holding you accountable.
Well, so that was us communicating and coming to the conclusion that you need to read Sun
that
Eater.
Felt, no, it was like that was animal-esque. Like you guys were attacking me. But Rich, what would your answer be to that?
I think there's the idea. So what I would ascribe personhood to, at least, maybe different from human, but the idea of personhood is being able to act on higher wills than an animalistic will, the idea of vice and virtue, that anger being a normal human animalistic feeling but not acting on it, and being able to resist your own urges, I think is what makes us people. And so that's why we don't hold animals accountable to murder, really. It's because, well, they can't help it. They can't resist their urges. And so that's what makes us human.
Really interesting answers. And Jared, we don't want to take too much more of your time. Do you want to conclude with any thought or also anything that you have, any projects you got going out there? Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, no, it's been really great. I don't have any like final words of wisdom. I've probably rambled too much. I apologize to everyone who watched this thinking that we were going to talk about a lot of science fiction. And instead, we just like bounced like a lot of questions around each other. We spoiled Ender's Game and that's it, basically. Yeah. But, you know, I hope people understand that you can explore these big philosophical ideas sometimes just by reading, but also by talking with people, and it's open to anybody. And if you like doing that kind of stuff, just come check me out on YouTube or check out my Substack. I think it's pretty good. So you might too.
So is our book club, Rich, isn't it?
Oh, we didn't mention book club. Oh yeah, we have things to plug. Mm-hmm. Yeah, go check out our book club. Link in description. It's fun.
We read sci-fi.
What
do
you guys
read?
What are you guys reading right now for your book club?
Well, the one that was just picked was Lions of Al-Rasan. And very excited to read. Have you read Guy Gavroquet before?
Yeah, I've read
Guy Gavroquet.
Yes. I really like Guy Gavroquet.
I'm used to talking to people like me who haven't read a lot of authors. You know, I'm realizing we are two different beings, and you are elevated. I understand. You have.
I didn't mean to be an ass there. It was just like, no, I really like Guy Gavroquet. Like a Guy Gavroquet book is definitely like my top 10 fantasy books. And it's Tigana, though.
This will be our first Guy Gavroquet.
Oh, okay. You're going to love it. But you should also read the Sarantine Mosaic. It's a little duology that's Sailing to Sarantium and Lord of Emperors. You got to kind of consider them as a unit together. Okay. So they're both like 400 pages. Just treat it like, I don't know, a Brandon Sanderson book that's actually good.
Oh my God.
What a spicy way to end it. Oh.
Goodbye, everybody.